All right, today's topic is free will. And as you all heard, since we had a snow day last week, we're going to cram it all into one 50-minute session. So free will. So let's start with a thought that I was just thinking about recently. So what shapes us more, nature or nurture? Right, so this is a great debate that we've had. Everybody learned in college all about, looks like most of you are in college at a time when there still was that debate, and probably most of you learned about that classic twin study case, right, where they had the twin boys where one was electrically circumcised and that didn't go so well for him, so they made him into a girl. Remember that story? Uh-huh. That's a fascinating story, yeah. So that was a classic study of nature and nurture, because now they had these twin boys raised by the same parents, twin born as boys, raised by the same parents, one now being raised as a girl, one being raised as a boy. So that was to prove that it's nature, that it's nurture, not nature. So that was the debate of the 70s and the 80s. Is it just nature? Is it just nurture? Sorry. Is it the environment and not something inborn? And myself having been raised in the 70s, so I know that was part of the debate of feminism, and you know, that's why you give girls trucks and boys dolls and, you know, see what they do with it. And then as you watch from behind the corner, you see the girl saying, this is the mommy truck and this is the baby truck, and now it's time for the truck to go to sleep, right? And the boy, meanwhile, lifts the leg of the Barbie and goes, right. So it turns out there is some nature involved. However, in this debate, it's really a false debate, according to Jewish thought, because what we're really shaped by is our choices. So we may be influenced by our nature and our nurture, but if we say, what are we shaped by, that's really a deterministic question. It's coming from a deterministic paradigm, that who we are is shaped by either our genetics or the environment that we're raised in, and that takes off responsibility for what we become. And the Jewish point of view is that we all have free will. So we all can use both our nature and our nurture to become who we want to be within the circumstances that we've been placed, but that we do have absolute free will in the moral sphere. So that's what we want to explore a little bit today. So this can be as discussion as you want. You don't have to just listen to a lecture. Ask questions all along the way, just so that you know. Okay, so the Bostoner Rebbe gave a friend of mine a very good quote. I have a friend who's a family therapist. And he told her that the greatest gift that God gave to mankind is free will. And unfortunately, he gave that gift to our children as well. So as a parent, it might be kind of nice to know that you have free will, but that our kids could be guided by our wise choices. And yet, the older we get, the more we see that it's absolutely up to them. So what is that free will? Why is it the greatest gift that God gave to mankind? What is our thought about free will? So does anybody have any thoughts about that so far?
I have a thought, which is if we didn't have free will, life wouldn't be very interesting or meaningful because we'd just be like robots.
Okay. Let's hold that thought for a minute.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
So interesting and meaningful, both of them, those 2 points.
There would be no purpose.
There'd be no purpose. So what do you see as purpose that's rooted in free will?
Well, God has certain expectations about our behavior, and if we don't have free will, it's all very meaningless. I mean, you know, we're not choosing between good and bad. We're essentially choosing a way that we're pre-programmed, a path that was pre-programmed versus one that has unknowns, maybe not to him. Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's good. So it could be that we're like robots, pre-programmed, or it could be that we're like animals, instinct. Yeah? We wouldn't learn anything?
Yeah, we learn more from our mistakes than we do from, you know, just going along a certain path and being good or something.
So you're saying free will is the basis of the ability to learn things as well. So when we so that may be the case. We'll look at that. But let's just look first at animals. Animals certainly can learn things, but they do learn differently than human beings learn, certainly. So a dog, does a dog have free will? Well, a dog can choose if he wants to eat or sleep right now, or maybe, and I'm not sure if a dog can choose to obey or disobey, or is that all conditioning? Maybe it's just if it's conditioned enough or not. But a dog can learn language, for instance. I mean, there are studies that show dogs can learn a vocabulary of over 100 words so that you can really say, get the ball from the dining room. And they could bring the ball from the dining room. They know which room that is and what a ball is and could retrieve it. So far, they don't speak very well. My dog, though, answers the sentence, life is rough. So I do have a speaking dog, but but how do they learn? They do certainly learn differently than human beings learn. So we can learn by conditioning, but if we want to learn in a deeper way, that is uniquely human, the way that we learn. And so let's look at what free will. So it could be robotic, could be that if we didn't have free will, we'd be like robots. Or it could be that we'd be instinct-driven. So that's not exactly robots. You are responding to stimuli. It's not clearly pre-programmed. But you don't really make choices when it's instinctual, not in a place of choice. So those two actually represent the paradigms of the creatures on the other side of the spectrum of us. So we believe that human beings are unique and that we're body and soul together. We're the only creation that has spiritual and physical melded into one being. On the other side of us is animals, all physical, and yet they certainly have a life force, but it's not a spiritual life force. But we call that life force that they have a nephesh, which is actually used, the same word is used for the lowest aspect of the human soul as well. But the nephesh is just an animating force. So we don't believe that dogs go to heaven, for instance. They don't create a relationship with God through their choices. So they do operate according to instinct. So they have some choice, but it's not moral choice. A dog will never wake up in the morning and say, today I think I'm going to work on being more faithful to my master. You know, my master has asked me not to lick the butter off the butter dish when he leaves the room, and so I choose to hold back my desire and not do that. That's not how they behave, right? You either cover the butter or condition them never to get on the table, but if they can, they will. So, right? The other side of the spectrum is angels, the other side of us, right? We have animals on one side of us and angels on the other side. So animals are all physical. We don't believe that angels are the next step for humans. That's not, you have to erase the It's a Wonderful Life vision of an angel getting its wings, right? Or a human being dying and then becoming an angel. That's not the Jewish concept at all. The Jewish concept of angel is an all spiritual being, which is basically a programmed spiritual robot. They don't respond to stimuli like an animal does. They have a mission that they're required to do and have no free will about whether they can do it or not. So they're basically like a neurotransmitter, a spiritual neurotransmitter. So just like a neurotransmitter brings the information from brain to finger, brain to face, or face to brain, I have a itch, finger, scratch it, right? The neurotransmitter is what caused that transference of information and made the information manifest. So an angel is like that. It's a spiritual neurotransmitter that makes God's will manifest on earth. So that's completely programmed spiritually, and that's completely physical. We are in between. So what's the in-betweenness of us? Why are we created this way? So part of it is that we're created in the image of God. And God has free will. We know that God has no image, right? Rabbi Wasserman once did a nice experiment that I just think was fabulous. Around this table, he had the Jewish Experience board. He handed out blank sheets of paper. And he said, everybody, I want to see a picture of God. So now everybody's wondering, because it's Rabbi Wasserman, right? And you know, Jews know there is no picture of God. What are they going to draw? So they're all thinking, you know, and some people start drawing. But one person, Scott Alpert, very smart, he picked up his piece of paper and he mushed it all over his face. And then he said, here, I'm created in the image of God, so this must be a picture. I thought that was such a brilliant response to the question, you know, an out-of-the-box, a brilliant response. So we're created in the image of God. What does that mean? God doesn't have an image. There is no physical image of God. So it can't be that we're created with the same shape, head, arms, legs, trunk that God has. It must mean something else. So what do we know about God, in addition to the fact that God has free will? God can do whatever God wants, right? What else is some of the things that's image of God?
God knows everything.
Good. God knows everything. So is that part of God's image? It's a question, but that's certainly a quality of God. What are some things? We know God is good. We know God gives. God is a giver, so that's part of the definition of God, is God is a giver. And this is a different class. We could talk about the nature of God some other time, but God is good. God gives. God has free will. God is one. We know God is one. And just to digress for one parenthetical second, so that's why human beings were created as one. If you ever wondered why the Adam creature was created as one, not in pairs like all the other animals, but was created as one and then divided in two, it's because we had to be created in God's image for God's plan to work out. So part of God's image is that God is one. And then we're divided in two, and then, so the whole point of our existence, what is the whole point of our existence?
Goodness. Come on. Goodness and kindness.
Goodness and kindness.
To improve ourselves.
To improve ourselves. Why? Good. So really the whole point of our existence is to use goodness and kindness to improve ourselves for the sake of getting closer to God, for the sake of receiving pleasure. Really the whole point of our existence could be wrapped up in one word, pleasure. Because God is a giver and God gives good. And if God wants to give the best good that there is, the best good that there is God. There's nothing better than God. Right? You know, there's a not a Jewish joke, but it's from a Christian paradigm. What's better than God, worse than the devil? The poor have it, the rich need it, and if you eat it, you'll die. Better than God, worse than the devil. The poor have it, the rich need it, and if you eat it, you'll die. Nothing, right? So nothing is better than God. So if God wants to give the best good, then God wants to give God's self. How do we give ourselves to another? Through a relationship. And what's the strongest paradigm of relationship that we know about? Think about different relationships that there are, different relationships that we refer to when we talk about God. There's king-subject, parent-child, right? Those are relationships that we experience. We don't really understand king-subject. We're not scared of our president, you know, like there used to be a king-subject relationship. It's hard for us to understand that. We've read fairy tales, but we don't have that internal experience. But certainly parent and child, we have siblings, friends, and lovers. Lovers are the other relationship that's referred to as between the relationship between God and humanity is the relationship of lovers, or God and an individual person. So what is the difference between the relationship of lovers and all those other relationships, really? Or certainly the other relationships we talk about with God?
They're equal.
Excellent. They're equal. They're not top-down. They're a parallel relationship. So the relationship of lovers is a relationship based completely on free will. You're only in that relationship as long as you both choose it. And you're only in that relationship, the strength of that relationship is based completely on the lowest common denominator of the choice. Right? So a college co-ed who gets a crush on her professor, right? Is that a love relationship? It's not. It's still, as long as the professor is smart, it's a professional relationship. Because his relationship with her is professional. I'm the teacher, you're the student, even if she thinks he's the cutest thing she's ever seen. It's not a love relationship because that's not where the two parts flow and meet. It has to be where they both join. That's what the relationship is called. Right? Does that make sense so far? So if God wants to give God's self, if we want to give ourselves to another, the best way for us to give ourselves to another, the strongest way to not just give advice or money or time or our stuff, the way we give our whole self to another is in marriage, in that loving relationship with another, where we give ourselves to another. So God wanted to create a situation in which God could give God's self to another. But the way you give yourself best is through a free will based parallel relationship where both of you are choosing into it. And so God therefore had to create a creature that had complete and total free will that could choose to be in a relationship with God or choose out. But now let's go back to pets for a minute. Whoever has had pets, what could you have a closer relationship with? Relationship. A snake or a dog?
Dog.
Right? Why? Hamster or dog?
Dog.
Right? Rabbit or hamster?
Not sure.
Right? So right, not sure, right? So why? How are you evaluating how you could have the closest relationship with these animals?
How much like humans they are.
Really? That is it. How do they respond to you? How much like humans they are? How similar are you to that? With a dog, you can see the emotions on their face. You see embarrassment, you see love, you see shame, you see, right? You can see, you don't see that on a snake's face, right? They're just not so cuddly. I mean,
they just don't care.
Right? They don't. But a dog is very different. You have a very different type of a relationship with a dog. Even a dog and a cat, there's a difference. Obviously, I'm a dog person, not a cat person, but cats are a little more skittish, but you could probably have a stronger relationship with a cat, let's say, than a rabbit, too, even though a rabbit could be cuddly, and even if they were tame enough that they didn't bite or whatever, like, you could train a rabbit, and they could be friendly. Still, it's not the same as a cat, so we're the same as a dog, which is much closer. So we can have a stronger relationship with entities that we are more similar to. So, therefore, God needed to create, if he wanted to give God's self to another, needed to create an entity that could be similar to God in a way, similar enough to be able to be in a relationship. But the more similar one is, the stronger the relationship can be. So think about marriage, right? You both figure out that there's something similar in you. Even if you don't share music tastes or art tastes, it doesn't have to be that similar. But certainly there needs to be similar goals, similar general ways of approaching things, so that there can be that basis for relationship. And then as you grow in the relationship, think of the difference between a marriage on day one and a marriage on 30 years later, right? Or whatever space you're in, 10, 20, 30 years later, how similarly you grow together and how much stronger, hopefully, the relationship is as you're able to finish each other's jokes and tell stories in tandem and understand what the other person means with just a glance. Because you've created a life together, and the more similar you become, the more flow there is. Doesn't mean, again, you have to share music tastes. It doesn't have to be that kind of similar. But there's a similar in flow of energy, similarity there. So with that understanding, then you could see that the more similar you become to God, the more you can have a relationship with God. Because you're more God's type. Right? So we want to make ourselves into God's type so we could be in that relationship so that we could receive God, which is really good, ultimately. So how do we do that? We have to have free will to be able to choose into this relationship. And then we have to have conduits to be able to build the relationship with. We know with our spouses or close friends to recognize their birthdays and what they want for their birthday, to bring them coffee the way they like it, in the cup that's their favorite. And we know all these little things that build a relationship or detract from a relationship. And there's not a point system. You know, you forgot to bring me coffee this morning. Today it was really nice, you know, and that there's points. It all flows into one creation of a relationship where good and bad doesn't cancel each other. Good and bad creates the nuances of this very varied relationship. Hopefully, in general, it's better than worse, but it's all part of one. Right? There isn't canceling each other out. There's no mitzvah point system. Right? So within a marriage, it's not a point system. And with God, it's not a point system either. It's not like that a mitzvah and an aveira cancel each other. It's that they're all part of creating one relationship. So the one relationship is created with free will, has to be created by definition with free will. Otherwise, it's not a relationship. Otherwise, it's like us and a dog. It's not really a relationship. I'm in charge. I feed. I take care of. Maybe they bark for me when somebody comes to the door, but, you know, it's not a relationship, really. It's certainly not a parallel relationship. So there has to be free will for that relationship to be strong, and there has to be free will to decide to create the relationship, and then there has to be conduits through which the relationship is created. So that's the whole mitzvah system, what that's about, is want to build the relationship. That's all the do mitzvahs. Want to not detract from the relationship, avoid these areas, all the don't mitzvahs. So the don'ts are relationship detractors, the do's are relationship builders. So, okay, so that with that in mind then, since we were created in the image of God with free will, with the power to give, with the power to create, God is a creator, so that's one of the other definitions of God. God is a creator. Also, interestingly, and this is important to keep in mind for this whole thing, God is unique. There's nothing like God. And so are we. There's nothing like us. Right? There's never been somebody who has the same parents as me, who has the same learning abilities and disabilities, the same allergies, the same eye strength, the same physical strength or weaknesses, born into the same century, in the same socioeconomic bracket, in the same city, who could do what I could do with my circumstances. Nobody ever has been born exactly like me or like you, ever, or could be. It's not possible for everything that's in you to converge exactly like it has, ever in the past or ever in the future. You're completely unique. And so living in that uniqueness is also an emulation of God and also makes us more God's type in a way so that we could be in that stronger relationship. So using all of these qualities, our uniqueness, our ability to give meaningfully, working on our goodness to transform things, to ultimately transform ourself. Really, that's the whole point of wearing a body for 90 years, 120 years, because we're a soul before we're born and we're a soul after we die. So we could really ask, what's the point of being here? Right? If God wants to have the relationship with that soul, why dip through this? Right? And the whole point of dipping through this whole existence, coming into this world, is all about how do I transform myself? How do I make myself into that relationship? How do I spend time creating relationship? The soul can't operate on its own. It has to have a body to operate through. So the soul can exist on its own, but not operate. So it needs a tool to operate through. So that's the body, is the tool for the soul to do what it needs to do through. That's why we're a mitzvah-based religion. Mitzvahs are all about something physical to do to affect one's soul. So a physical pathway to affect something spiritual. So free will is all about choosing which physical pathways do I want to take part in so that I can affect my soul however I want to take it, however I want to affect it. Now, do we make a choice over everything that we do? We don't really. We also have instinct, right? So we can live our lives by instinct, constantly seeking that which is pleasurable and trying to avoid that which is painful. And many people live like that. But what makes us uniquely human is the ability to transcend that. So let's just take a college example, right? So the college kid sitting in his dorm, somebody comes over and says, hey, want to go out for pizza and beer? Right? So pleasure says, yes, instinct is, yeah, that's what I want to do. But now he has to think to himself, what will give me more pleasure, pizza and a beer right now or an A on the test that I'm studying for? Because I probably can't have both, right? I need to either spend this next 4 hours studying for my test tomorrow or I can go out and have fun. So now I have to choose the pleasure that is more important to me. So instinct just pushes you in one direction, but the intellect can take you out of instinct and then you can make a choice about what you want to do. You can evaluate the pleasure. So you're still, in a way, choosing by pleasure. But you can evaluate the pleasures and make a choice that's not based in instinct. It's based in an evaluation of levels of pleasure. So the ability to override instinct is uniquely human. Animals can do things that are amazing. You know, an animal can put themselves in the way of harm to save you, but it's their instinct. If you've created that type of faithful relationship with an animal, they might do something incredible, but that's driven by instinct. But human beings can be driven by free will. So where does free will operate? We don't have, well, let me ask you, where does free will operate?
I guess I'm confused because I think I could believe that somebody's instinct would actually be to study for the test and to avoid.
It could be. It's possible that that could go into the category of instinct. Let's say, could it be instinct? Certainly could be conditioning, right? Could definitely be conditioned into a person so that they might not be making a choice about it. Mm-hmm. That's just an example. So parables are for examples to learn from. They're not the specific thing. So it's important to be able to expand that further, that it's just an example of how one might have an internal feeling, whether it's, then we can expand it to whether it's by conditioning or by instinct, that one could examine and then transcend. So we can transcend those choices, transcend choices that are, that an initial gut choice could be transcended by intellect. So free will. Where do you think free will then operates? We can't choose our looks. We can't choose our parents. We can't choose the circumstances we were born into. Often we can't choose the circumstances that we're in. We can do a lot towards those circumstances. We could choose to learn about health and live a healthy life, right? You could brush and floss, but you still might have Swiss cheese for teeth. I mean, there are people who do that, right? But genetically, there are people who are just, it doesn't matter what their choices are. And there are people who never brush and floss and whose teeth are perfect, right? So frustratingly for those who are trying to be careful, right? So that's in teeth, but in other things too. There are people, you see people who eat organic and are constantly thinking about health choices and they're sick, right? And it wasn't because they're sick they chose to be organic. They're first organic and then they, and it doesn't matter. And people who eat Bomba all day long, you know, ice cream and cookies, and they're the picture of health, right? People who study for tests and get C's. And people who sail through school on A's with zero effort, right? All they have to do is show up and they like automatically write beautifully and express everything perfectly. And they just, their effort is just in showing up to the test, basically. So do we get to pick? We don't always. We know people who've graduated from college and are struggling to put food on the table and people who dropped out of high school and who are millionaires, right? So yes, we can make choices in the directions that we'd like to go, but do we ultimately get to pick our circumstances? We don't. So Viktor Frankl actually asked the question, where is free will in human beings? Do you know who Viktor Frankl is? He wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning, which is a pretty short book and a well worth the read. He was a psychiatrist who lived through the Holocaust. So he's already lost his position in the university, and he's already lost his private practice, and he's already lost his home because he's been taken away from it and separated from his wife. He didn't have children. So he's lost his wife now. And now he's on a train. He doesn't actually know where he's going yet, but he's on a train with a bunch of people who no longer have their university professorships and their private positions or their homes or their spouses, just a bunch of guys on a train, gets to the camp where he's going. Again, he still doesn't yet know where he's headed. But he's told, so all he has no possessions either. He just has the clothes that he's wearing and the manuscript for the book he's been working on. That's the one thing he tucked into his jacket pocket. So he doesn't have a suitcase, no change of clothes, no other stuff, but he's got that. So when he arrives at the camp, the guards tell him to everybody go into this room and get undressed. We're going to issue camp clothes, right? So he gets undressed, throws his clothes on the pile, but then he takes his manuscript and he goes over to the guard and says, would you mind if I just keep this? And the guard says, where you're going, you're not going to need that. So no. So now he's standing there naked with nothing. Now he's starting to think, he might not make it. Obviously he does. He wrote the book, right? But now he's thinking, how is he different than a cow waiting for slaughter? What differentiates him right now, naked with nothing? No past, no connections, no saviors, no nobody. No intellectual future, like he has nothing that makes him human except for he's still a human being. So he's now using his analytic mind to think, what makes me human right now?
How he treats other people.
How he treats other people? What else?
How he decides to respond to the situation he's in, how he decides to see it and react to it.
Excellent. That's where our free will is. It's not in whether I'm in the camp or not. It's not whether I'm in the car accident or not. It's not whether I have a difficult child or not. You don't get to pick that, right? It's not whether your kids are fabulous or not. That is not your choice. But how you respond to it is 100% your choice. So free will, where is free will? It's in our desires and in our response. That's where we have total freedom. What we hope for and wish for and how we respond to everything that's been put in our lives. That's where total free will is. And so free will really is in the moral sphere, and only in the moral sphere. We can choose to be moral or not moral according to how we respond to the stimuli, according to what we choose to hope for, wish for, what our desires are. That's the only place where total free will is. So that's where you're not conditioned necessarily, and there's not instinct. Now, so there is some conditioning in a family, and I thought about this when my daughter was in a public school setting for a little while and came home with another high school freshman from a very different world than my daughter was in. And so I was trying to get to know this girl as I drove her to our house to work on a project. The two girls were going to work together on a project. So I said, so Jasmine, what do you want to be when you grow up? She said, well, I'd like to be like, not a stripper, but a dancer. I thought, oh, she said, or a bounty hunter. This is a true story. So I didn't really know what a bounty
hunter. Exactly the same. The and the
so I did not really know what a bounty hunter was, but I didn't want to show her my ignorance. I said, really, that's so interesting. So what kind of career preparation is necessary to for a career in bounty hunter? She said, I don't know. I said, but this summer I'm going to get a job. I said, you are? What job are you going to get? She said, I don't know, just my mother says I can't work in food service. I said, oh, okay, so what would you like to do if you could have any job? She said, well, I think I'd like to work in an office. I said, oh, that's interesting. What position would you like to have in an office? She said, I think I'd like to be a coworker or something. I'm thinking, oh, my gosh. Like, I mean, here it is so stark in this card, the difference between these two girls and where they come from. And I just had this flashback to when I brought my eldest home from the hospital after she had just been born to my in-law's apartment. And on the sign, on the door was a sign that said, welcome home, future college graduate. And I thought, oh, that's kind of a heavy trip for a newborn. And yet, that's the expectation that she was born into. You know, not if college, which college. And for sure you will be successful. This is not an option. You know, you will be a giver. You will transform yourself and the world. You will be successful. You will use college as a stepping stone onto that. But definitely she's born into that world. And Jasmine was not. Not at all. So I really saw there is a dream difference, not so much a socioeconomic difference, because there's poor people in my neighborhood. The Colwell families, I mean, they're living on $40,000 with eight kids. You know, what is that? That is not a lot of food on the table. Let me tell you, that is struggling for mortgage and food. So they're poor. But they're not that. You know, they have hopes and dreams. That it's a dream difference. So there is a conditioning of dream difference, I think, in where you're headed. But even within that, each person gets to pick their own path. So, but where do we get to pick our own path? Let me make sure I'm heading good on time. Excellent. So we have this concept in Judaism. The phrase was actually coined by Rav Dessler, Eliyahu Dessler. It's called point of choice. So everybody's choice operates at a different point. And one's point of choice is set by all the choices that they made previously. So they're born at a certain point of choice. Bless you. But the point is dynamic, not static, according to what the choices are that the person makes. So let's imagine somebody born into very difficult circumstances, right? Imagine somebody born into an angry family, not even a family, a single, young, single mom, born in the ghetto. They live a life where everybody around them steals and hurts and is unkind. So their choice when they see a woman running through Central Park is not, will I rob her? That's not the choice, because for sure they will. They've been conditioned for that. But their choice is, will I hurt her? Right? So if he chooses not to hurt her when he robs her, he's actually chosen up. And the next time, or maybe the first time, the choice is, how much will I hurt her? If he chooses not to hurt too much, the next time the choice is, will I hurt her? Then the next time the choice might be, should I rob her? Then the next time the choice might be, so you choose yourself up, or choose yourself down. But the choices that you make are what sets your point of choice. So I'll just give you, for instance, like where our points of choice might operate. So none of us are shoplifters, hopefully, right? We're not the type. We wouldn't do it. It's so far behind us in where we're thinking. We're not walking into King Soopers thinking, I'm going to steal a candy bar, or I'm going to steal batteries for my iPod, or something like that. We're all thinking we're going to buy it, right? So now you've walked in. You just did a big grocery shop, $150 worth of stuff, right? It always works out that way. You go in for eggs, and $150 later, you're out at your car loading it up, right? You needed batteries, not for your iPad because they don't take batteries, so you needed dental floss. And you're loading everything into the car, and all the bags are in, and now you see the dental floss in the bottom of the cart. And you realize, oh, I didn't pay for it. But I need it. I'm out. And I really don't feel like going back in. And I just spent $150. How many times have I gotten spoiled fruit from King Soopers? This probably counts against something that I bought that was spoiled that I didn't return, right? Should I take it or not take it? That's the question now while you're standing at your car. Do you take it? That would be stealing. Do you rationalize it? It's against the spoiled fruit that I got. Do you leave it in the cart? That's allowing somebody else to steal it. Do you bring it back into the store and pay for it? Do you bring it back into the store and just leave it? Like, that's where, anyway, my point of choice would be, right, is in that. I would never walk in and steal dental floss, but I might wonder at the cart, what do I do now? Right? So that's where my point of choice operates. After I've made the decision a few times, then it's clear that taking it in is just obviously what you're going to do. Right? You're not thinking about it anymore. Oh, it's there. Let me take it back inside. If you're in a hurry, so you're just going to take it back inside and leave it. If you really want it that minute, so you'll take it back inside and wait in line again and pay for it and then leave. So that's where. So our point of choice is different every time. Let's just take kashrut, right? You start keeping kosher. So somebody who chooses to begin the process, so they decide they're going to not eat pork. So then eventually they go to a friend's house, they smell the bacon and they're thinking, that's so good. I mean, I decided I'm not, but it smells so good. But I'm not, because I decided I'm not, so I'm not doing it. After a few times, it's not even a question. They don't even have to wonder, should I, shouldn't I, how strong am I in this commitment? That becomes conquered territory, and now the point moves. So one could choose to take on something else or not, but it's no longer a battle. So what Rav Dessler talks about is how the battle front, the point of choice is always at the battle front. You never fight the battle in conquered territory or in territory you don't have access to. Right? So somebody who doesn't keep kosher at all is not thinking about which hechsher do I hold by or not, right? That's territory that they don't yet have access to. Which kosher symbol do I find more reliable? Right? That's I mean, there is a kosher keeping world that will say, well, I don't go by that one. I don't eat triangle K, I only eat OU. I eat OU and OK. I eat OK for cheeses and vegetables, but I don't rely on it for meat. I want chassidische hechshers for meat, right? So there are people who live in that world, right? People who are first thinking about pork are not thinking about that at all. That's deep into the other side, right? So the battle's always fought on the front, but the front moves depending on what you conquer, right? So, and the front is always static. It can go forward and it can go backwards depending on the choices. So who we are really, who we are, if you want the essence of who we are, is the conglomeration of our choices. We are really one big package of what our free will has made manifest in us. And the more we understand the impact of free will on the shaping of who we are, the more we can utilize free will in shaping us, in being proactive in shaping us. So we can, as part animal, because we are physical and spiritual, we can, as the part animal selves of us that we are, slide back into pre-programmed instinct or straight-up conditioned pleasure seekers. And so you will find people who are conditioned for college excellence even, who are just kind of moving through life. Yeah, they're taught to study well. They study well. They were taught to get A's. They get A's. It works out for them. You know, like, they're not going to settle for a B. They'll do the extra credit, write the extra report, whatever they have to do. But it's conditioning for that person. It's not free will for that person. So their free will operates, that's already conquered territory. Their parents conquered that territory for them. That's why they're conditioned that way. So as much as parents, as much territory as we can conquer for our children in providing the conditioning, then they can start from there. But who they actually are is defined by the distance that they accomplish. So the starting point, nobody's held accountable for their starting point or even their ending point, because it really depends on how far they got. So it's really the distance that we're all held accountable for. I used to give a parenting schmooze. It was a schmooze, not a class, because I was not as experienced a parent at the time. So I had a woman in that class. We talked a lot about not yelling, a lot about keeping your voice calm, a lot about educating and not berating. It's one of my mantras as a parent, educate, don't berate. So a lot about that. And I would constantly see her berating her children. And I'm thinking, you've been in my class for 3 years and you're yelling like crazy. Really? I mean, like, how effective a teacher am I, or how are you not working on this? So then one day I met her mother. And after I met her mother, I was like, oh my gosh, you are so good at this. You've been taking in every single word that I've been teaching. Like, it's amazing how much progress you've made. And like, it's the distance that you've created from how you were raised to how you are now. It's phenomenal, right? And I just, because I didn't know where she came from, I didn't know the what she had accomplished. So again, it's important not to judge people for what you see, but to realize you're only seeing a snapshot of where they are. But it was just amazing to see. So she, the same behavior in her, the same behavior in me that I saw in her would be completely unworthy. I came from a very con mom. I was in a parenting class once, 100 women in the White Shul in Long Island, taught by a psychologist, son of a rabbi. All right, so it's all religious Jewish ladies in this room, 100 of them, learning parenting techniques from the son of the rabbi, the psychologist, right? So he's got lots of credibility for all these religious ladies. So he's busy saying how it's important not to yell. I'm thinking, I don't yell that much. Important not to get angry. I'm thinking, I don't get angry that much. So I'm busy patting myself on the back that I've really worked on my parenting. I'm a calm parent. And he says, you know, one thing that Jewish parents have in common with Mediterranean parents is a lot of yelling. I'm thinking, not me. I don't. And then all of a sudden, it dawned on me, I wasn't raised Jewish. I converted. So I wasn't raised Jewish, so I was raised by a much calmer mom. That's why I just got like a huge head start. And have to overcome all of that. So I like totally burst my bubble, thinking that I've like really, I did work on it, but I like just started from way further down the road. So anyway, so our point of choice is where we start and then where we begin to choose. So we begin to choose where nature and nurture brought us, but that's our point of choice. That's where we begin to choose. And then we choose ourselves into different realities. Wherever we choose to head, that's up to us. And really the distance between where we came into the world and how we exit the world is who we are. That's really the measure of who we are, is that distance. And so we do come into the world to transform ourselves through our free will. Any questions on this so far?
Do we miss something in our own self-actualization when we're given additional opportunities for knowledge? And I'll use the example you gave with Jasmine.
Mm-hmm.
I feel you might have missed an opportunity to elevate her intellectual capability by just explaining to her, instead of just inquiring, but actually explaining, well, no, here's the next steps that you need. And then it's incumbent on her to take that knowledge and make the choices. But mm-hmm. My question to you, I guess, is if you take someone who's born, you know, at a certain level,
mm-hmm.
and now you bootstrap them to several levels, have you... Do we lose the opportunity to make the choices necessary to elevate to the same level?
Let me see if I understand your question. So your question is, if we assist somebody in seeing a reality beyond where they're holding, do they then lose the credit that they could get from traversing that distance on their own?
Not even the credit, just... Do they now, does it change their path to the point where they'll make choices that wouldn't be innate to their own qualities, to their own environment?
I mean, I think we do. I'm not 100% clear on the exact question, but certainly we do have the responsibility to change the world as Jews. And one thing that differentiates us as Jews from non-Jews is that our responsibility is to impact the planet, to impact the way that people view their ability to choose and the type of relationship that they want to create, their raison d'etre, and to help people make good choices. So helping people make good choices would include making sure they're fed and safe and educated, and those kinds of things that we Jews and those who follow in Jewish pathways, whether they've learned it through Christianity or through other methods, those things that we try to do, that we do try to create an environment for, I mean, now, universal education and for blind justice and for world peace and for seeing the inherent dignity of every human being. These are all Jewish concepts that the world is taking on now slowly, but it is our job to impact the planet so that these things will become the baseline from which people can then make decisions, and then to help people understand that they make decisions, they can make decisions within that. You can't really make decisions, you can if you know about it, but it's very difficult to start thinking about free will and how it operates when all you can think about is how I'm going to get my next meal. You know, really, if you're on that level, which is not something we really experience in this country to the level of desperation, but in other countries, you know, it would be very hard to talk to somebody about free will when they're digging roots and really just trying to get enough to stave off starvation. So we try to create an environment in which that's not the reality, that where people are fed, where there is some health care, where there is education, where there is access to ideas and exchange of ideas, and then from there, really free will can take off. So that's why Jews work very hard on social justice and on helping others. So we do have that responsibility. And it's possible that it certainly is the case that within a short interaction with somebody, a Jasmine in a car kind of interaction, that you want to offer them. So in a way, I did offer her something. You could pair up with another student, go to their home, work on a project, and bring something to completion, even if you didn't manage to achieve that in school. That's just a level, right? Of course, there's much, much more. Then we have to make choices about where does our responsibility go? Is it the whole world? Then we'll be scattered. Or do we start family first and then move out that way according to the ability of our energetic selves? Some people have a lot of energy and some people have a little. You have to know who you are so that you know what to impact and how much you can impact without diluting other things. So all of that comes into it. But as Jews, we are supposed to be leaders in showing people how to use our free will to make good choices, to create strong relationships, to eventually create a strong self that can be in a strong relationship with God that will ultimately bring the whole reason for creation into fruition, which is not made manifest in this world, but this is the world of working on it. It's actually manifest in the next world, the world of living in that relationship with God where one receives pleasure, only pleasure, because that's not what we get here. Does that help with that question?
Sure.
You want to make it more specific now that I said all that? Look. Okay. Right, so we are supposed to help jumpstart people, and we all come into contact with people who do shift a perspective for us. And so sometimes we don't have to go through a whole long learning process because we've got a shift in perspective. So, and really it's often dependent on our choices if we could have that shift in perspective or not. Many people are exposed to the exact same talk. Everybody in this room is going to walk out with something different from today. Right? Everybody's exposed to the exact same language coming out of my mouth, and yet, because of everybody's different selves and ability to process and choices that you've made, where you're holding and what your desires are, everybody's going to come out with something different. So that also. So we can catapult people or not, depending on how receptive they are also to that ability. So I don't know if that helps at all, but let's make this... Okay, good. Good. Okay, we have just a few more minutes, and I want to put into this one more concept here. And this is the concept of God's all-knowingness. So this is a classic conundrum. How does free will work in the face of God's all-knowingness? Right, if God knows everything, do you really have free choice? So this is actually something that we're told not to contemplate too much because it's beyond our capacity as human beings to really figure that out. However, as a parable, only as a parable, so remembering that parables are just using language to help us understand bigger things. As a parable, I'll give you an example of how this might work together, right? So a young child, a five-year-old, comes in, right, before dinner and says, I'm hungry. And you say it's better to wait for dinner because that's healthier, right? You're trying to educate them about nutritious choices, and you've talked to them about why carrots are better than chocolate and all that stuff. Right, but they say, but I'm still hungry, I want something. So you're going to give them something. So if you offer them, you could offer them, here's two scenarios, a carrot stick and a celery stick. And if they pick one, they just picked one, right? You can't pat them on the back and say, good choice, because it's the same choice, right? Just one is orange and one is green, but it's the same choice. But if you offer them a chocolate kiss and a carrot stick, and they choose the carrot stick, then you can say, good choice. I see you've been listening to what we've been talking about, nutrition and making healthy food choices. Good choice, because you offered them different things. Now, That's a mushel. That's a parable for two concepts. One is, why do we have choices that are negative? Why does God make the negative so available to us and so delicious looking? Because there can't really be meaningful choice without different things available to us. So that's one thing to learn from the story, right? Why is the negative so easily available and so delicious? So that you can choose, so your choice is meaningful. But also, as the parent here, you could make it a starker choice, you know, a carrot stick or a piece of raw liver, right? Which one are they going to choose? You know, but they still get to choose. The fact that you know and make it whatever you want it to be so that you know your child, right? You know that child. You know what they will choose and what they won't. But just because you know doesn't mean they don't get to stand there and pick. Their ability to choose is not influenced by your knowledge of what they will choose. Does that make sense a little bit? So it doesn't make sense. So, because you could, it's possible for you to create a scenario in which you will know for sure. Now, obviously, as human beings, we won't know for sure. For sure, for sure, for sure. They could always shock you and say, I think I'm going to try raw liver today, right? It's possible, but highly unlikely, but it's possible, right? So, but you could create it so that it's so strong. You know your kid hates Brussels sprouts and they love chocolate kisses. You're going to offer them a Brussels sprout and chocolate. You know they're going to take the chocolate kiss. You just know it, right? So, but they still get to stand there and choose the one that they want. So your knowledge does not take away their ability to choose. So this is just a parable, and it's much stronger with God. God for sure knows everything, because there is no past, present, and future for God. It's all in one. Time is a construct for human beings only. So my past and my future is already known to God. It's exactly the same. It's exactly the same as my present in God's eyes, so to speak. He knows everything. So right now, it's the temple is being destroyed and the new temple is being built at exactly the same time. Right? The Twin Towers are being first conceived of and fundraised for, whatever they did to put together the investors in it, and destroyed at exactly the same time in God's world. Only in our world do we see a continuum of time. So with that in mind, we know God knows everything, and yet he still put us, made it so that we could choose. Part of that has to do with the contraction of God's self, that God actually did. There's a Kabbalistic concept of God's contraction, that if God is everything, not just is everywhere, but is everything, that God, in order to create this world, had to contract himself to create space in which to place the world. So God is called the place. The main time that we use God's name, the place, is when we comfort mourners. And in English, we say, may the omnipresent comfort you among the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. But in Hebrew, it's ha-makom yinachem etchem. Ha-makom, the place. The place should comfort you. We don't often refer to God as the place, but that concept of God being the place is that God is the place. And in order for us to be here, he actually had to contract himself out of the way for the world to exist. It's another discussion, but as he did so physically, so to speak, in order to allow this physical world to exist, he also had to do so with his will. Because, of course, God doesn't will that somebody fly planes into the Twin Towers, but God does will that there would be human beings with the ability to choose. And so God had to contract his will, so to speak, to a certain place to create space for human beings to have free will. So God had to choose between, do I want the world to run sunny and happy, pleasure number one, or do I want human beings to have the ability to have free will, to create a relationship through free will, so they could have a stronger relationship with me, pleasure number two. So he chose pleasure number two, really, the more sophisticated pleasure, which requires unpleasant things in the meanwhile. So just like somebody who is studying for a degree will set aside resources, live with less money, sometimes live poor, eat pasta for years, right? Because they want that degree. So they will set aside certain pleasures, and even there'll be some difficult times, but they recognize that they're working towards a goal. So again, this is a parable, but in order for the system to work, that there should be creatures that have total free will so that they can choose to be in a relationship, there has to be space created for free will. So God can know and allow space for free will at the same time. So again, we're told not to contemplate it too much because it is outside of a human brain that lives within time to actually be able to understand that. But it just hopefully can help a little bit with the amount of understanding that we could approach at this point. So with that in mind, I would just like to say a take-home message might be to recognize that while we have free will, our children do too, and our spouses and our friends, and to create space for them to be the co-creators of themselves that they need to be in choosing, helping to support them make good choices, but help allow them to be in sometimes negative places so that they can actualize their free wills to actualize themselves. So that.